From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Gary Lilly.
Good morning out there in America land. Good morning to our troops around the world. We're, you know, that thin green and blue line that's protecting us and every other country in the world. And good morning to my veteran brothers and sisters, and welcome home. Good morning to all our friends down there, down under in the Australian continent and the South American continent. Appreciate your emails. Keep them coming. I'm Gary Lilly, CB, Chu Lai, Vietnam Republic of 1966. And in the booth right now is Dale Thronberry.
Good morning, Gary. This is Dale Thronberry, 195th Assault Helicopter Company, the Republic of Vietnam. Boy, you might sound like you were reading official orders there.
I was thinking about a movie I saw a while back.
Anyway, good morning, everybody. And yes, our greetings to all of our listeners around the world on the Internet. It's very exciting that we're getting these emails now from all over the place. And also our air boss today.
Andy Penny.
How's it going? Andy Penny, August 10th, 1982. How about that?
That's not a date of service. That's a date of birth. The kid.
The kid.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. And later on, we're going to be going into an interview with Bob Feller, the legendary Hall of Fame Bob Feller. It was pre-recorded. He was on a real tight time schedule the other night. That was pretty interesting, wasn't it?
It was very interesting. You'll be able to tell he's on a time schedule as we get up toward the end of it. He's an interesting guy. And for those of us that are over 55, let's put it that way, I'm sure that we all remember what a great pitcher he was during the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
I didn't like him because he was always beating the Detroit Tigers.
Well, that's, you know.
Cleveland Indian pitcher. Boy, did he have a fastball.
107 miles an hour, he said.
Astounding, isn't it? Astounding. Right now, though, we're going to get in and talk to Peggy Costello of Project Salute. Good morning, Peggy. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning, Gary, and thanks for having me on today. And let me first thank all the veterans who are listening for their service to our country. We really, truly appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a privilege to serve this country. Not at the moment, but afterwards. Tell us what Project Salute is, please, Peggy.
Project Salute is a project of the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, which includes both the Veterans Law Clinic, where we train students to work with veterans, primarily in the area of veterans benefits, and also have a mobile law office, actually two, which we take throughout the state of Michigan and also throughout certain cities in the United States to which we've been invited.
I can see that those cities range from Texas to North Carolina, Alabama, Minnesota, Ohio.
Yep, that's true. Lots in Florida. We've been to Florida quite a bit. We like to go there in the winter, of course. Currently, the mobile law office is in North Carolina this week, and we'll be in South Carolina in 2 weeks.
Okay. How can people find the schedule? Then we'll get back to what it is.
Sure. On our website, which is www.law.udmercy.edu, that's www.law.udmercy.edu. There's a link that you click to on Project Salute, and it will give you the schedule both in Michigan and around the country for the next few months.
We're always adding to it, though, let me say. Pardon me?
We're always adding to it, so you may find new sites if you go there a day later than you went last time.
I think I see December on there, so planning quite a ways ahead. What do you do for the veterans, and how do they pay for it?
Well, first of all, the veterans that we see don't pay for it, because we primarily service veterans who are low income if we actually handle their cases. But anyone, no matter what their income level, can call us, and we can give some direction. We can give referrals either to veteran service officers, to other attorneys, if they've got the resources to pay for attorneys and they need attorneys for different matters, or we can simply answer their questions. But to actually qualify to have their case handled, they must be relatively low income, which is 200% of the poverty level, approximately $20,000 or so for a single person.
And what kind of cases do you represent?
In the clinic, we handle almost exclusively veterans benefits matters, people who are at various levels of trying to obtain either their service-connected benefits or pension benefits. We have some discharge upgrades that we handle. And then in some cases, we do handle ancillary legal matters for people. For example, a criminal expungement or a minor misdemeanor matter or matters with creditors, simple will, power of attorney, things of that nature.
But you, as an example, would not do criminal defense?
Not unless it was just a misdemeanor matter. If it was a misdemeanor matter, we sometimes, and we're working with the veteran on other areas, then we would go with them, for example, you know, public intoxication or some sort of minor matter that they've gotten themselves into, parole violation perhaps. We could help them with that in many instances.
The veterans are in need, great need for the benefits. Because I know a veteran that lost a toe to frostbite in Korea, and the VA said, "Prove it." Well, he showed him that his toe was missing. They said, "Prove you lost it in Korea."
Right, so, exactly.
And so that's where you guys would step in.
Yes, and again, we do, the system, as you mentioned, is very difficult to navigate. We also do a lot of education for veterans groups, actually go out and talk to them about what you would have to show, how you could possibly prove that you lost that toe in Korea, even if there was no medical record from your medical file in Korea.
Peggy, thank you very much. We're out of time, believe it or not.
Okay.
We'll get it on the website. Thanks, Peggy.
Thanks so much.
Dale, we're going to be welcoming home some troops. Hopefully that list will start growing as they start coming back.
Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women from around the country who have served in our military. We do this to let them know that we honor their service and commitment. Dateline, Bradenton, Florida. Dozens of flag bearers stood lining a quiet residential street in Bradenton last week. Curious neighbors peered from their windows and yards as members of the Patriot Guard and the Christian Motorcyclists Association parked their motorcycles and took a place alongside the road. Conversations almost became whispers as everybody waited. Across the state hours earlier in West Palm Beach, 1st Sergeant Aaron Cornelius, 4th Battalion, 64th Armor, had climbed into a white minivan with his wife for the last leg of a journey that started months ago. He was finally coming home. As Sergeant Cornelius' motorcade grew closer, flags were straightened, some people stood at attention and saluted along the side of the road. Sergeant Cornelius, unfortunately, would see none of it. In the Dora District of Iraq almost a year ago, Sergeant Cornelius was blinded in an explosion that killed the rest of his squad. Sergeant Cornelius could not see his welcome home, but surely he could hear and feel it. As Sergeant Cornelius exited the minivan, he was enfolded into the arms of family members and friends. A line formed, and solemnly each rider welcomed home the man they had come to honor. Tears flowed as each man walked up and hugged 1st Sergeant Aaron Cornelius. "It's so good to be back where people love me and care about me," said Sergeant Cornelius. "Now that I'm back, it's my turn to go help people. I want to become a mentor to help the next wounded soldier," he said. "You know, the military can be an ornery place for you, but the camaraderie and closeness will definitely be missed." Dateline, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A local group of soldiers recently back from Iraq received a welcome home. The 303rd Psychological Operations Company based in Oakdale received a welcome home at Fort Bragg and a larger festivity at the Soldiers and Sailors Hall in Pittsburgh. Dateline, Fort Hood, Texas. 4th Infantry Division families were reunited with their soldiers at a special welcome home ceremony at Cameron Field, Fort Hood, Texas. More than 200 soldiers assigned to the Special Troops Battalion arrived after 15 months in Iraq. On behalf of a grateful nation and all of us at Veterans Radio, we welcome home our troops.
And Dale, we were talking about it the other day about how that list is going to grow, and instead of welcoming home individuals, we're going to be welcoming home divisions.
And battalions. It's a great thing. We're so happy to welcome these people home, and they deserve it.
We'll be right back. As a 17-year-old rookie in 1936, Bob Feller struck out 8 players against the St. Louis Cardinals in just 3 innings. In his first start, he struck out 15 players. And before he was out of his teens, he struck out 18 Tigers in one game. And Bob Feller pitched a no-hitter on his opening day in 1940. You earned the nicknames of Rapid Robert and Bullet Bob. And then December 7th, 1941 came, and Bob Feller volunteered to be in the Navy. Bob Feller, welcome to Veterans Radio. You were on the, you volunteered for the Navy, is that right, Mr. Feller?
I volunteered a couple of days after Pearl Harbor, and I signed up on the 9th of December and went to War College after boot camp. I was assigned to the battleship Alabama.
That was the
which was completed in the Navy Yard in the Portsmouth, Virginia, and sailed out of Hampton Roads. That was our home base. We spent 11 months taking supplies to Russia, and then we went out into the Pacific and spent almost 2 years out there getting General MacArthur back to the Philippines and on to Okinawa. And then I returned, of course, and played ball for another 10 years with the Cleveland Indians.
And you missed probably the four years that were in 1941, you won 25 games, and in 1946, 26 games in between, other than a short span in 1945. You were in the military. You ever regret enlisting?
No, I never had any regrets. We won World War II. It was an all-out war. It was a war we had to win. And to protect the sovereignty of the United States of America, I didn't regret it at all. I thought I made a very good decision when I decided to join the Navy. I went to Chicago the day of Pearl Harbor to meet the general manager of the Cleveland Indians to sign my contract for the next year. I told him that night, on December 7th, I was going to join the Navy. And Gene Tunney, the head of the Navy Physical Fitness Program, flew out from Washington on Monday and swore me in Tuesday morning at the recruiting office in Chicago. I went right from there to Norfolk for boot camp, and then on to the War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and back to the Alabama. And I had several weeks between the college at the War College and the Alabama sailing for Europe. And so I played ball with Norfolk Naval Training Station there for a few weeks before we took off for our convoy duty, taking supplies from Murmansk and Archangel for 11 months. And I played ball in the South Pacific, too, on some of the islands in the Pacific where the CBs had made ball diamonds out there on some of the islands, and we had ball games. We played at the other ships, and I played catch aboard ship quite a bit, besides giving exercises every day to, when the condition permitted, to the crew of the board the Alabama. That was my job, to give exercises twice a day, one half the ship at one time and half the other ship another time, to keep the officers and the crew in shape. And sometimes we did it and sometimes we couldn't, depending on what the situation was at the moment.
I imagine north of the Arctic Circle it was a little difficult to play catch.
Speak up.
I said I imagine north of the Arctic Circle it was a little difficult to play baseball. Play catch
well,
on the show.
We were in Iceland in the summer one time. We played a softball game in Reykjavik, there at the Navy base in Reykjavik. And I didn't play baseball in Iceland, but we did play softball a couple times. And in the middle of the summertime, when the sun was up, the sun never went down. And it was daylight all the time when we were playing up there. And we didn't do that only two or three times. And we went to, we didn't stop there that often.
It was surprising to me to learn that the Alabama was assigned to the British Home Fleet for some period of time at the beginning of the war.
Well, we were there with this battleship South Dakota, and one of our carriers, the Ranger, was with us, and we had a few destroyers and other ships, capital ships, the cruisers, heavy and light. Had a British kind of carrier there, the Illustrious, and also the heavy cruiser, the Rodney. Was with us, and we had other escorts, but we did take Liberty ships full of supplies to Murmansk and Archangel during the winter of 43-44, and it was very, very cold, and then we headed for the 42-43, I should say. Then we headed to the Pacific and spent about not quite 2 years out there before I came back, and was a manager of the Great Lakes team at Great Lakes, Illinois, where we had a very fine Major League ball club and playing games against all the Major League clubs and a lot of other clubs and Air Force bases and other professional teams and amateur teams for the entertainment of the personnel. They had 110,000 satyrs at the lakes then, Great Lakes going in training.
That's where I took my basic training, was Great Lakes. I was a CB myself. And one of my uncles was a Navy gunner on one of those Liberty ships.
Those Liberty ships had the armed guard aboard on it. Had a small gun on the bow. They didn't have a whole lot to protect themselves with. We were supposed to protect them all. I only ever saw one of them get sunk, and we rescued everybody who was on that.
Oh, really?
On that particular ship, it got hit with a torpedo.
That was up in the North Sea, was it?
Man, in that particular instance, thank heavens.
Was that up in the North Sea? On the Merman's
Run? It was up there in the North Atlantic, yes. It was up somewhere off the, like south of Iceland, a little bit southeast of Iceland where it happened. But we got everybody off before they had to hit the water.
I'm sure they were pleased with that. That water is cold up there.
We played ball in the New Hebrides. We played in the Fiji Islands. And the Seabees, of course, the Seabees got started down there in near Ocean View at Little Creek, Virginia, where they started. They had the first Seabee base. Then they opened up a couple more for training purposes. One of them was on the West Coast, and another one, I think, was in Bainbridge, Maryland. But the Seabees did a tremendous job in the Pacific. I didn't know anything about what they did in the Atlantic. They did a tremendous job in the Pacific and all those islands, going in and securing them and helping build up the bases that we needed for staging bases to win that war out in the Pacific. The Seabees certainly were a very big part of winning that war.
Well, they set quite a standard for us guys that came along later to follow. Just one last question about that North Sea. Now, you were on the Murmansk run. That weather is terrible up there. What was your job on the Alabama?
Well, I was a gun captain. I was on the anti-aircraft guns, and we were on the main deck, on the port side on the main deck, about three-fourths of the way back to the third turret, just near the third turret on a fantail. And it was cold, it was windy, and it was wet. And it was pretty tough duty. We were standing 4-hour watches, 4 hours at a time, with about 25 men on the guns, and on the 40-millimeter quads, which I was on.
Okay.
Sometimes we had to secure the gun if the weather was really too tough. You couldn't. The waves were too high. It was too wet and too cold and too much ice. But the destroyers, of course, it was tough for the destroyers because they had to chip ice all the time. The battleship didn't have to chip the ice. And we did have aircraft cover, of course, and then the new German planes would come out every now and then, take a look and see where we were, what we were doing. And, of course, you'd take a shot at them and hit one once in a while, but not too often. But after we finished, got rid of the Von Tirpitz, the battleship Tirpitz, we call it the Tirpitz. It was hiding in a fjord in Norway, north of Trondheim, and the British helped sink it with their bombers. We shelled it and torpedoed it, and that was the last ship the Germans had. Then we went to the Pacific. But it was 11 months taking supplies to Murmansk and Archangel, and through the ice, and we had icebreakers and so forth. For big Russian icebreakers, took us right into the ports. But then the Pacific was all across the equator 28 times in 1944. In our natural operations, trying to catch the Jap fleet and win back the Pacific.
The Japanese had quite a fleet too. In fact, theirs was a bit larger than ours, wasn't it? At one point,
I didn't get that.
I said the Japanese fleet was a bit larger than ours at one point, wasn't it?
Well, the new battleships, the ships that were hit at Pearl Harbor, on the attack on Pearl Harbor, the battleships, they were World War One vessels. They were not as good as the Japanese battleships. But the new battleships, like the Alabama and the Wisconsin and New Jersey and the Missouri and the Iowa and then South Dakota and Massachusetts, the Indiana and the North Carolina, our new battleships are better than the Japanese, and that's why we won the war. We had very good cooperation and very good teamwork, too, from all the sailors, and a great admiral out there in the Pacific, too, was Admiral Nimitz, who was based in Honolulu. We had Admiral Michener. We had good captains aboard our ships. We had great teamwork, and teamwork won that war.
And you, your ship was looking, your task force was always looking for the Japanese. Now, you never saw them in a surface battle, but you had quite a few encounters being attacked by air. Is that not right?
Well, we had air attacks, and we were involved in that Mariana, what they call the Mariana Turkey Shoot off of Saipan in the Philippine Sea. We shot 474, I believe, Japanese aircraft down one day. Our fighters got a lot of them, and our aircraft batteries got them. So that was what they call the Mariana's Turkey Shoot, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force. We sunk a couple of their carriers, maybe three of them, and other warships, cruisers, et cetera. I don't think we sunk any battleships. We might have damaged a couple of them. But that was what they call it, referred to in the Navy as the Mariana's Turkey Shoot, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force.
I think you sunk.
That ship went down that day. It was in June 1944.
I think you sunk three carriers and damaged the fourth one.
Well, we did a lot of damage, and that was the end of the Japanese Naval Air Force. And they knew then. They knew when the sun went down that night. Their officers knew that the naval war was over, and they had lost.
Let me ask you this: when you're under air attack like that, you've got every gun firing, I imagine, at least on that side of the ship. What was the noise like, and what was the feeling like, or were you just too busy to have feelings at that moment?
Well, that's about it. You're just too busy. There's a lot of noise, of course, and a lot of firing, and a lot of smoke, and a lot of tracer bullets flying around. And you always think that none of those bullets have got your name on it. It's got the other guy's name on it. Of course, you really know in your own heart you might find one that has your name on it. If one has your name on it, you're a hero. If it doesn't have, you're a survivor. That's the way it is.
You just described it quite well. On the way over to Vietnam, I was looking at the rest of my squad, and I thought, gee, I wonder if any of these guys are going to get it. Thought never occurred that it might be me. But I want to go back to baseball just a moment. When you signed, you were 16 years old. Gordie Howe, the great hockey player for Detroit, signed for a team jacket. You got a dollar and an autographed baseball. You were 16. You could have broken that contract the next year.
And well, I still have the original contract written on a piece of stationery from a hotel in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm from near Des Moines, Van Meter, which is 15 miles west of Des Moines. And I got a dollar and an autographed ball by the Cleveland Indians and signed with Cy Slapnecker. He also signed free players like Lou Boudreau and Mel Harder and Trotsky and Herb Score. And
great names.
Most all the Cleveland players. He became general manager. And he was a man I was seeing in Chicago on the night of December 7th to sign my 42 contract. I told him I was going to join the Navy. He said, congratulations. I'm going to go back to Cleveland, resign. I'm tired of being general manager. He's there 6 years. I'm going to go back to scouting in Cedar Rapids. So Cy Slapnecker did that and went back to scouting in Cedar Rapids.
It was a different era then, and people had different values.
Well, the values were completely different. We had a lot better leadership than we have today. In fact, we don't have any leadership today that I care for at all.
We could spend a lot of time talking about that.
Except Bob, the head of the Pentagon now, Bob Gates, he's a very good leader, but he's about the only one I know of in Washington at the moment that I trust.
Had you broken that contract, you could have gotten, according to some sources, $100,000.
Well, I was signed illegally, like most. A lot of players were signed that way. Right. And those minor league teams had territorial rights to sign all the free agents in their area, but all the major league scouts were cheating and they'd using false names and et cetera, to sign the players. I was managed to stay with the Cleveland Ball Club. They changed that rule a few weeks later in the winter of 1937 at the major league meetings. There are no more territorial rights for minor league ball clubs to sign players and sell them to the big league clubs who finance them.
And you never looked back after you got the dollar when you, some sources said you could have got $100,000 the next year.
Well, that was the American way of doing things. It was opportunity.
Yep.
I had the opportunity to make good, which luckily I was able to do. Had a lot of help, of course, from Cy Slapnick and my parents and the coaches and the teammates. I was lucky enough to have a good career, and I'm very happy today being here in Arizona with the Cleveland Baseball Club, working out in the beautiful complex here in Goodyear, Arizona, right near Phoenix.
I understand you threw out the first pitch for their new ballpark.
I was one of the first pitches. A couple other people threw, and the mayor and one of the sponsors threw out the first pitch. I threw out the last first pitch in uniform, of course, the Cleveland Indian uniform. It's a big honor, and I do appreciate it. And they're doing a good job for us here in Goodyear, and we're drawing quite well. And we got a state-of-the-art facility. I'll be here till April 1st with my wife, Ann, to go back to Cleveland after April 1st when spring training closes up.
We're coming up on the first break, Bob, and I just want to mention one thing before we come up on the break. Your dad is the guy that got you pitching, tossing the ball back and forth, and he built a ball diamond that with the stands.
My father built a ball diamond on the farm in Iowa, the Oakview team. We were there 4 years. Of course, I played 4 years of American Legion ball. I played a lot of semi-pro high school, summer vacation Bible school. I was playing ball ever since I was 9 years old.
Okay, real good. Well, we're coming on the break, and we'll be right back right after this, and you are listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Captain Edward Allworth led his men across the river by swimming it. Details: while his company was crossing a French river and canal at a bridgehead during World War I, the bridge was destroyed by shell fire, and Allworth's command became separated, part of it being on the east bank of the canal and the remainder on the west bank. Seeing his advance units making slow headway up the steep slope ahead, he mounted the canal bank and called for his men to follow. Plunging in, he swam across the canal under fire from the enemy, followed by his men. Inspiring his men, he led them up the slope, joining his hard-pressed platoons in front. By his personal leadership, he forced the enemy back for more than a kilometer, overcoming machine gun nest and capturing 100 prisoners, whose number exceeded that of the men in his command. The exceptional courage and leadership displayed by Allworth made possible the reestablishment of a bridgehead over the canal and the successful advance of other troops.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Bob Feller, Hall of Fame baseball player, known as Rapid Robert and Bullet Bob for his 100-mile-an-hour-plus fastball. You were clocked right after the war when they finally had radar. How fast was your fastball, Bob?
Well, they clocked me. It was a full electric cell device from the Aberdeen Ordnance Plant, Aberdeen, Maryland. They call it the Proving Grounds. Military Proving Ground. They checked in 1946 in Washington, D.C. with that equipment. It was 107.9, and that was, of course, you couldn't maintain that during a game. Maybe you could maintain 103 to 105 on a good day, or maybe a little better occasionally, but I had a good curveball, but a fastball has to have some movement on it. If it didn't have movement on it, no matter how hard you throw it, it's not going to fool the hitter. You have to have some movement on the ball.
And did yours move?
Everybody, Americans all like speed, and the speed, of course, is important. And control has to have a big – control is a big factor also.
And that was one thing that you were known as, for getting a little wild every now and then. Do you think that helped you with the strikeouts? I mean, who
– Almost all fastball pitchers have a little wildness. You have a big windup. And you have a lot of motion, and you have a lot of leg action. And you can't be a dart thrower out there when you're throwing real hard, using an awful lot of body strength to propel the baseball. So most fastball pitchers walk quite a few hitters, and they foul off a lot of them. And I was right amongst them and walking a lot of hitters when I first came up. And after I gained my control, it was much easier and made the game much easier for me. But
I imagine as a batter, I wouldn't want to dig in too much if somebody's
throwing.
Well,
those were the days before they had helmets, and of course the batters were a little bit apprehensive and maybe a little bit afraid of some of the wildness of some of the pitchers. But
with good cause.
If you don't have a helmet on, you're going to be a little bit loose up there at the plate. You got some wild guy out there on the mound, and and but it did help probably indirectly.
I remember one Detroit Tiger game when they were playing against Nolan Ryan. Gates Brown was a great hitter, became a batting coach afterwards. He got up against Ryan and he struck out, and as he was walking past Jim Northrup, who was going up next, Northrup asked him, "How's he throwing?" And Gator said, "Don't go up there." So you were compared.
Well, those are jokes.
Right. But you were compared to Nolan Ryan.
All those rainy day stories everywhere, and they may be true and they may not be, but it's possible. There's a lot of funny things happening in the game. Baseball is a game of inches. Is your fair, foul, or ball or strike, et cetera, et cetera. And almost all sports are games of inches, and there's a lot of luck involved in professional sports as well as amateur. And if you're lucky, in a lot of cases, you're going to have a better career. And some days you're lucky and some days you're not. And you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days, and you have to be able to accept that because you have to give the other fellow some credit. Give the other fellow some credit also.
They're all pros. The some players played against you and also played against Ryan. Have you ever heard any of them make any comparisons?
Say what?
Some batters batted against you, and they also batted against Nolan Ryan. Have you ever heard of any of them making a comparison?
I don't. I would not know of any hitter that ever hit against me in my prime and ever hit against Nolan Ryan. I don't think that's possible, and I'm not going to buy that at all.
Okay.
I don't think that's true.
I'm going to scratch.
Whoever said that, I don't think knew when our career started and ended.
It was on the internet on one of the stories about you. Let's go back to the military then. You had a great career in the military. Your ship was awarded battle stars, and as you would get them too. How proud of you? Have I already asked you that about the?
Well, I'm satisfied with my decision I made on December 7th to join the Navy. I had planned on joining the Navy back in 1939. I knew we were going to be in the war, just a matter of when. And I came in as a chief petty officer and went right on into training at Newport, Rhode Island, and then aboard the Alabama. I was always a chief from the day one when I swore in. And that was what Gene Tunney, the director of the athletic department of the Navy, gave me, and because of my enlistment. And I was in the Navy 4 years and 2 days as far as, even though I was on inactive duty for 2.5 months, just when the war was over late August 1945, went back to Cleveland and continued my career, and I had my best year in my career. And the next year, 1946, was my best year.
Just out of curiosity, what did a chief petty officer make in those days? Do you recall?
Well, I think we got about $80-some a month, and then, of course, sea pay and combat duty, you probably got about double in the 160s, perhaps, per month. But
that was about what
thought about that. We had unrelenting resolve that we were going to have to win the war.
Right. I mean, that's about what I was making.
That war was a war that had to be won. Otherwise, it was Hitler, and the Axis would have dominated the world, and we had a war. That was a war that we had not only in the military, but at home, in the factories, and on the farms, and all over the United States. We had unrelenting resolve. We're going to win it. And they helped cooperation, and everybody had. We had good leadership in the military as well as politically, and in every way, we had great leadership in those days. That's why we won the war.
And the people tend to think, okay, we saved the United States. I mean, it was truly saving the world. There's a lot of countries that are free today because of what you guys did in World War II.
Well, the United States won that war for the rest of the world. It hadn't been for the United States, that war would have been lost, and we all know that.
I have several Australian friends who are Vietnam veterans who say the same thing that you just said.
I was in Vietnam in 1969 with General Creighton Abrams. And also with General William Yarbrough, head of the Green Berets. I spent several months over there visiting the fire bases and the pacification centers and flying the Huey helicopters all over the country, all the way from Da Nang down to the Mekong Delta. I was there. I saw what was going on over there, and That was when Johnson, when President Johnson was there, and McNamara was the head of the Defense Department. We could have won that war if they would let them. They just wouldn't. They just wouldn't let General Abrams do what he wanted to do, neither he nor Westmoreland. And the two bombed the supply ships up in Hanoi. If they'd have bombed the supply ships, they could have won that war, but they wouldn't let them do it.
It's hard to win a war when you're afraid somebody's going to get mad at you for it.
They had their hands tied behind their back. That was a problem.
One of the partners here on Veterans Radio is Dale Thronberry, who was a helicopter pilot at the same time that you were there. Dale, would you like to say hi to Bob Feller?
Hi, Mr. Feller. Everybody
knew that was a war, that they just didn't want to win it. They were afraid of the Chinese or whatever. I don't know what they were afraid of, but it was a lot of bad judgment in Washington that the one that caused it to lose that war. If we lost it, which I think we did, and because we had over 50,000 men over there dead. What a waste of not being able to win.
Mr. Feller, this is Dale Thronberry. I'm one of the other sponsors on, or the other speakers on Veterans Radio, and I wanted to ask you about some of the other ball players that were with you during World War II that you can remember. And we're old enough in here to remember you and Ted Williams and some of the other players. And I was wondering if you could tell us about some of the other ball players that were in World War II.
Well, a lot of ball players, a lot of minor leaguers as well as major leaguers, and there's about two or three major leaguers got killed in World War II in the combat. Ted Williams did not get into combat in World War II. He and his squadron with John Glenn got to Honolulu. The war was over. They never were in combat. They got in combat in Korea, where Ted threw 39 missions. And Lew Brissy was in combat in Europe, and so was many others, and including Warren Spahn, and other lesser-known names were in the Battle of the Bulge, or in Italy, or in France, and in on the beaches over there when they invaded, and in the Navy, of course, in the Pacific. But I know Elmer Gideon got killed in the war. He was from Cleveland, Ohio. He was playing for Washington, D.C. Harry O'Neill played for Baltimore and got killed.
We're coming up to a break. Our last break.
This is the last. I'm not going to go through any more breaks. I'm all through with you.
Could you hang on then for just a few minutes?
I'm not going to go any longer.
Okay. Well, Bob Feller, Hall of Fame pitcher, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. We're back on Veterans Radio, Dale Thronberry and I, and we're still laughing over Bob Feller's farewell speech.
Well, we told you he was on a time schedule. We just didn't know it ended that quickly.
It's a funny thing because that is typical of a lot of farmers. They're very abrupt, but they're outspoken, and they have just a way of talking that makes me laugh. I was doing an appraisal for a farmer many years ago, back when prices were cheaper, and he asked me what I thought it was worth, and I said about $1,000 an acre, and he had an 80 on one side of the road and a 30 on acre parcel on the other side of the road, and he said, well, just last spring, a builder came up and he told me that he'd pay me $2,000 an acre for that 30 across the road, and I asked, why didn't you take it? And he thought for a second. He said, son, that was the day that two fools met.
Yeah, it was interesting listening to Bob Feller. I think I told you the other day that when I first heard his voice, I said, I recognize that voice. And I had heard it when I was a kid. I guess he'd done an interview or something on a sports program. Yeah. And, he just says exactly what he thinks. I think what's interesting is a couple of things that we were talking about earlier is his dad had built the ball field for him and had charged admission actually for people to come and watch these teams
during the Depression.
During the Depression. And I was wondering, we didn't get a chance to ask the question, if the baseball diamond from Field of Dreams, which was built over on the east side of Iowa, was motivated by Bob Feller's dad on the west side of the state.
Well, that's a great thought because he had bleachers there and charged 35 cents admission for those games and had as many as 1,000 people show up. That was before his pro career.
I think that 35 cents was probably more than it cost to get into a Yankee game.
Probably. And if you think 1,000 people out in farmland in those days, they had a lot of them traveled from a great distance.
I think it's one of the things we want to point out, especially to our listeners, this is to motivate you to go back and talk to any World War II veterans that you may know of and get their thoughts down, because there were so many questions after listening to his interview that I thought, I mean, his physical trainer in the Navy was Gene Tunney,
right,
who was, I believe, a heavyweight champion of the world. Didn't he fight Jack Dempsey or something? Some famous bout that I remember hearing.
I remember him as a champion boxer, and I can't remember the details.
Yeah, it was something about either Dempsey won or Tunney won or something, and the guy goes, Dempsey's down. I remember hearing the radio broadcast of that. But, you know, find out these things. The other question I had, since you're in the Navy, I wanted to know, what exactly is a fantail? Do you know?
The fantail?
Yeah, what is that?
Back end of the ship.
Oh, I thought that was the stern.
Well, yeah, but the fantail, I think, is the part that hangs over. I was a CB. I'd never stepped foot on a ship. But, you know, on the back end of a ship, there's part of it that hangs over. I believe that's the fantail.
Okay. Well, again, encouraging people to go out there and get these stories down. The other thing we talked about, can you imagine in one of those inter-service games, Bob Feller pitching against you at 107 miles an hour, which today is unheard of. And we get all excited here in the Detroit area when one of our pitchers hit 100 miles an hour one time in a game.
Right.
And he said, well, yeah, I could, you know, 107, unusual, but normally 103 to 105.
Yeah.
Without a helmet.
You couldn't maintain 107. You could only pitch 103 to 105. And he was known for being wild, and as he said, all, you know, fastball pitchers are. I read his autobiography, or a biography, I learned from talking to him, you can't believe everything you read, that he was pitching against the Boston Red Sox and had no hitter going, and walked three guys in the bottom of the ninth. And next guy up was Ted Williams. He let the ball go, fastball. Williams hit it. He said he didn't even look back. He just started walking off the mound. He knew they'd lost 4-3.
Can you imagine watching those players go up against each other? I mean, it's what myths and urban legends are made of, as he pointed out.
Right. The thing of it is, the teams are, not that these guys aren't great athletes, but they're watered down quite a bit compared to those days. When you got on a major league team, you were really, really good.
Well, you only had 16 teams, first of all. I mean, even I had a cousin that played Marvelous Marv, for those of you out there that followed the Mets and the Yankees, unfortunately. But here's a guy who set the record for home runs in Colorado in the minor leagues, and he batted maybe 230 or something like that. And he was only known for the beer ads he did for Miller Lite in the early 70s. But I keep telling people, he made it. You know, can you imagine just making it to the major leagues for those of us who are frustrated baseball players?
Me, the guy that they called Sausage Arm? No.
Well, we wanted to talk just briefly before we run out of time here about other people that in this greatest generation that participated during World War II were not only ball players. I remember seeing a picture, I think it was of the DiMaggio brothers, Joe and Dom, in the Navy uniforms.
Right.
And you know, even though Ted Williams didn't get into action, we knew about him. And I know that there were many, many more that we
well, Charles
never heard
Durnan,
of.
Who was the actor. The actor.
Little chubby guy.
The heavyweight actor. He was on the program called Evening Shade, is where three Purple Hearts, a Silver Star, and one of the Purple Hearts, I remember reading the story, it was when near the end of the war, when the Germans were using old men and young kids, he said it was about a 14-year-old kid is what it looked like, coming at him with a bayonet, and he couldn't shoot the guy because it was just a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up getting a bayonet through the shoulder because he was trying to just fight him off rather than kill him. Lee Marvin was a driver of one of those tracked amphibious vehicles, mm-hmm, in the Marines. He was in the first wave at, I believe, Tarawa. Might be wrong about that battle, but he was in the first wave of one of those major battles. Clark Gable.
Right.
Gunner on a ball turret on a B-17. And
we mentioned Jimmy Stewart, who who flew bombers over Europe and also ended up staying in the Air Force in the reserves, ended up being a brigadier general in the Air Force, and ended up, I can't remember the name of the movie, you mentioned it before, where he kind of played himself flying, right, you know, these big giant super bombers.
SAC, which stood for Strategic Air Command. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was almost autobiographical.
We have to point out to our audience, we understand that almost the entire population was involved in World War II, unlike, you know, the conflicts that followed. So we're not trying to degrade anybody that's out there that's playing ball or anything today, because we know that if there were another national emergency, that probably everybody would step up to the plate, just as they always did. Every generation is the greatest generation, I think.
I agree with you on that. I've got one last little anecdote that I read about with the actor Glenn Ford. It was in the Battle of Iwo Jima, and the rifleman that was telling the story, and they were under intense Japanese fire. He was hiding behind a rock, and a guy hit the ground next to him with a Thompson submachine gun, rolled over to reload it, and he looked him in the face, and it was Glenn Ford. And he said, "I thought all you Hollywood guys were back selling war bonds." And Ford said, "Yeah, right." Reloaded his Thompson, jumped up, and that was the last he saw him running off. So these guys, a lot of them were in the thick of it. Dale, do you have anything that you wanted to cover?
If we got about a minute or so left, we just wanted to ask people to help us out. You know, Veterans Radio, we're trying to do a little fundraising here. So if you go to our website, veteransradio.net, click on Founders, we're trying to buy some equipment. We want to buy some recording equipment and some editing equipment to upgrade the quality of our program. So we need your help. So if you get that opportunity, we would appreciate you doing that.
You too can be a sponsor of Veterans Radio.
That's right. You too. You can become a member of the Veterans Radio Network. That's what we're working on next.
And look forward to next week's program of who do we have?
Not sure yet.
Not sure yet.
Thank you, Andy.
You're dismissed.
The opinions or views expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or the station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.